to Hogcast. I'm Bob Jennings with the 442nd Public Affairs, and I'm sitting here with Chief Master Sergeant Nate Sparks and Brigadier General Steve Nasty Nestor. And this time, instead of doing the interviewing, General Nestor is going to be the interviewee.
Well, kind of. I'm going to ask some questions, too.
All right,
Bob.
He has a hard time.
We'll see how it flows.
We'll see how my ADHD goes. It's Chief Parks. It's not Sparks.
I'm sorry.
It's Chief Parks.
It's fine. Very forgettable.
That's good. That's good. Well, just I think before Nate starts firing questions at me, so I've known Nate. When did you get here? 90s?
2001.
2001, right? I knew him since he was in here. And he went on to do other stuff outside the 442nd. And we can get into that later. But fast forward to when he becomes a command chief at Grissom. And that was my first base.
Yeah.
Grissom Air Force Base. My dad flew there for years. And I always wanted to connect with you when you were living there, but we never did, when I would go back to see my family. And he goes, hey, I got this great thing. And we're talking leadership. I've heard great stories about the way you speak and the way you lead and some of the things you had done from Torch, from Riddler, from different people, and Angry, who you worked with at...
At Creech, yeah.
At Creech, and Rose's this, Rose's that. So he sends me this podcast called Fuel, Grissom's Air Refueling Base. And I listened to it, and I was like, man, that's really good. Like, that's awesome information. It's a great way to connect with people. So I kind of stole, like I talked to Torch about, I steal ideas from smart people, smarter than me. And that was one of the ideas I stole from Nate. So we always wanted to do a podcast together, Nate and I, because he's really good at it. And he gave me some feedback. I did my first podcast. He said, that was cool. You did pilots, war stories, but you kind of need to talk to the airmen a little bit more. And it's about the 18 to 22 year olds that have questions and don't know this stuff. And every podcast you do, make sure you're teaching them or communicating something to them better. So he gave me some good feedback. So Nate, anyway, thanks for coming to the Change of Command. Thanks for coming up to kind of talk to our enlisted force. If you don't know, he is the chief of the chiefs group. So what that is he kind of helps place all the chiefs, correct?
Yeah,
in the Air Force Reserve.
Talent management and senior leader development.
Yeah. So he, in my opinion, he's probably like one of the top four or five enlisted people in the whole Air Force Reserves, right? You have the command chief for General Healy and the NAF command chiefs, and I would put you right up there with those four guys. Is really one of the top four or five enlisted leaders that we have, and it's been awesome to watch your career and watch you excel in the jobs that you've had.
Yeah, I appreciate that, man. I think watching, same thing with you, watching the different pieces that you go through and stuff like that, and the different steps that you took, and it's amazing, right? And it's sometimes hard to believe because you're like, I still see myself as, you know, Staff Sergeant Parks sitting over in this other building, right? And just we just shared some stories a minute ago over lunch of just some of the crazy things, but all good times. And you look around and you talk about stealing stuff. And I tell people that all the time is, man, don't be afraid to steal from those that are around you. Not physical things, but the leadership qualities. And we looked in that room today, in that hangar, there were some pretty phenomenal leaders.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Some people that went on to do some amazing, amazing things. That touched a lot of lives even here. So when you look at that and you look at your influences and like who's on that for you, like who really you look at your leadership side, like who shaped you, you know, in that
way? I take a little bit of the stuff. And it's funny because I think when I was younger, nobody really saw me as a leader because I was the goof off guy. But when I flew, I was real serious about it and I was a good pilot. I think I earned some credibility as a pilot. And then once I got an opportunity to lead, I did pretty well. And a lot of people were actually surprised. Like when I got the squadron commander job, they're like, you're going to get fired.
I think we were all surprised.
You're going to get fired in 2 weeks. I mean, you're crazy. And I've done some stuff over my career. I'll be honest that I could have lost my career over. I refueled with no clothes on one time.
Yeah.
And, I got grounded for a month for that by Colonel Disarude. And there's lots of things. Like I told the story last night about getting almost kicked out of Italy. Lots of mistakes that I made that other people kind of would steer me back on the right path. A lot of guys, man. My dad, number one, he did 37 years in the Air Force. Lots of different jobs. And I just, to see him and what he gave to the Air Force, more so after he retired. He was president of the ROA.
Yeah.
And he still really cares about benefits for citizen airman.
Right? And when I was at Grissom, he was involved with the Grissom Museum up there. They thought very highly of him.
Yeah.
Went over there.
He and a guy named Boyd Ashcraft.
Yep.
And General Ashcraft, I knew since I was a kid, we'd vacation with their families. He came to my UPT graduation. And I was a guy that was very fortunate, man. I think that's why I continue to try to give back. It's because Ashcraft and my dad and these guys, I got hired into that Grissom unit at 22 years old, right out of college. Didn't do any active duty time. And a lot of guys used to call me, hey, you're Silver Spoon, man. Your dad's a general.
Yeah.
You got right into the reserves. Well, I got to Grissom and I flew and we closed a year after I got there. We lost the A-10. Grissom's still a tanker unit.
Yep.
I didn't want to fly tankers because I had just gotten checked out in the hog. And so I got the opportunity to, the 442nd hired me when I needed a job. I didn't really say it today, but it's kind of why this wing means so much to me. I needed a job. The 303rd, the 442nd hired me. I met my wife because of the 442nd.
Who hired you?
Mike Lynch, Royal.
Okay. Yeah.
Royal, Mike Lynch hired me. And guys like Phil Poland and Roger Disrude and Rhino was a leader then. Those guys hired me and they knew my dad. They had flown with my dad. So they hired four of us from Grissom, that the only four that wanted to come over here. They double slotted because we were closing. Those guys were huge mentors to me. I would tell you, Nate, every time I go, every time I listen to somebody lead, I take a little bit of each of them, right? And some of the guys that I've really, Royal Lynch is one of them. The speech that he gave when he did his change of command as the wing commander, the thunder and lightning and the passion that he spoke with, I was just like, I was ready to run out the door, jump into an A-10 and go anywhere he asked.
Yeah.
Over Turf, Heck Vet, Borgen. And then when I worked like at PACAF and I worked for General Wilsbach and got to listen to him talk about leadership, this guy's a 4-star general. He's moved 25 times in 37 years. He's commanded two wings. And he always talked about being humble, approachable, and
credible.
Yeah. And he was all of that and more. Indo-PACOM commander, Aquilino. Holy cow, did I just sit and take notes of listening him to learn what he wanted in briefs from other 2- and 3-star general. He's a combatant commander of Indo-PACOM. Mm-hmm. I get to listen to him. To go to a job where you're thrust into a situation where you're sitting and briefing 4-star generals as a colonel or a 1-star is a little overwhelming, especially when you're out of your element as a CAS pilot and you're in Indo-PACOM where they're doing bomber task force, space, cyber stuff that I'm not that good at. But you just dig in and build relationships with people and learn that stuff and then communicate it to them. I got to listen to General Van Herk, the Northcom guy at the CFAC course I went to. So I just take stuff from people I like. General Welsh, I use his stuff about, I heard him give this awesome speech about you can't lead people unless you know their stories.
Yeah.
And it resonated with me tremendously to get to know people's stories as a leader so I can better lead them. So those are some of the guys that mentored me.
So along the same lines, my influence, like what I've tried to base my leadership on, Theodore Roosevelt's quote of, they don't care how much you know until they know how much you care. Kind of the same thing, right? Is, yeah, I don't care. It doesn't matter if you're the smartest guy in the room. If they don't think you care, they're not going to listen, right?
Yeah.
And so there's so much to be taken from just caring, you know, for people. And I look at this and I said, today I was looking at, and I heard Colonel Leonis talk about this too, is this is the first time you really had a chief,
yeah,
like as a command chief, right?
Yeah.
And so we see this and I get to see this a lot in the job that I do now, is you have these single seat pilot who relies on themselves. You were probably a FAC guy, right?
Yeah.
So you were forward air controller. So you were controlling the skies and you come in the door and you want to take off sprinting. But now you're a command team.
Yes.
So let's talk to me a little bit about that and that relationship now, because I think there's a lot of people that the enlisted side, you got a lot of fighter pilots that are over there that are phenomenal. And if you look at that, like ops group, they don't have a chief.
No, it stinks. They should.
Yeah. And now you're put into leadership. You're a command team.
Yeah. And well, we had a chief, you know her, Carol Tripp, really well. That we worked with. I did learn a lot from her, really, about in situations like to talk about what happened to you when you lost your wife, and to see her step up and help you, right? And I learned empathy from her.
Remember how she used to, you'd walk in, she knew all your kids' birthdays.
Oh, yeah.
She knew the anniversaries. She knew, you know, big events in your life, like all those things. I look at that and I say, that was the example that we saw every day.
Sure. And they probably missed that over there, having a chief over there. They should have a chief. But yeah, I wasn't really, I heard, you know, you're a command team. General Scobie did a good job of teaching us that when we would hear him. And so did Radliff when at the 10th Air Force. I told the story when I met Chief Barian. I didn't know who he was, never met him. And I went to Tucson for the MLR. And I'm sitting at a different...
What's the MLR?
MLR is a leadership, or they call it the crucible. The 10th Air Force, all the wing commanders and command chiefs get together, 2 days of leadership, and then they break off. The command chiefs kind of talk about future command chiefs in 10th. Wing commanders talk about future commanders in 10th Air Force. I have people that I sponsor, right? I'm kind of like looking out for them. And I'm actually ecstatic because Todd Riddle, who wanted to come back here very badly.
I got to work with him again at the Pentagon.
Awesome leader. He's out at Luke. He's going to be the wing commander at Luke shortly. He'll be a GO, a general. He flew here for years.
Not shortly because of the stature, but just in time-wise.
Yeah. Yeah. Captain America. He's going to be a wing commander, and I'm sponsoring Rio. He's going to be a wing commander. Custer Kelly, who's working at ACC, was a group commander at Moody. I think he will be a wing commander. I think Virga Ramos possibly will be a wing commander. So that's my opportunity at the MLR to pick and find... I think the biggest thing you can leave is to find somebody that's better than you to take your job. So to kind of mentor them and mold them. And I see guys like Rick Mitchell and Rio and the guys that have come here. People did that for me, right? And you make the place better by finding your replacement and making them better than you. It's not a bad thing. That I really hope that Mike Leonis at Rio takes this wing from where it's at today to another level. And because then I did my job.
Right.
Right.
I've always said, I tell my boys is there's only one man that wants you to be better than them, and that's me as your father.
Yeah.
But then when I became a chief, I realized that, you know, as chiefs, we're trying to build people that are better than us. And as leaders, just like what you said, is you look at it and you're like, man, I got to accomplish a lot of things here, but I hope Rio's better.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know? I think, you know, and everyone who's, you know, the chiefs that have followed me, I give them the playbook and I'm like, hey, be better than me.
Yeah.
You know, don't make the same mistakes as me. But so let's go back to the, sorry, I sidetracked you with the MLR there. But so you and Chief Barian, talk to us about this relationship, because you walk in.
Yeah, we didn't.
It's like an arranged marriage, right?
And I guess sometimes if you don't, you can say, I want to pick my own guy, but I'll give this guy a chance, right? And he's from California, flat bill hat. I was living in California at the time. And we meet each other, and he was a little put off that I didn't sit next to him and find him at the meeting. I sat next to my buddy Wall Street, who was the wing commander at Barksdale, and we're golf buddies, and we're cutting it up, and we're getting ready to go to lunch. I don't even know if I went to lunch with him. I think I did, but I think he was like, who is this guy? I've heard stories about this guy. Mm-hmm. And I don't think we exactly hit it off great at the first thing, but then... we started to get to know each other, and you heard him last night. I think it's imperative that you're on the same page, right, as a command team, to where he's speaking the same message as I'm speaking, and I have his back. And he used to get a little bit embarrassed when I would brag about him coming here and working on computer chips. His wife's a Delta pilot. They don't see each other much. They got young kids, and he's flying out here, sometimes getting in at 2 a.m. and show up for an 8 a.m. day, and he's got his stuff together. He works a lot from home, not getting paid, doing stuff telecommute wise where he's building stuff for promotion boards or the RAD or the top six, rising six, top three stuff. He's doing a lot of work for this wing away from here. It's tough to come in here as a TR, especially a command chief, 5 days a month and make a difference. But I think he figured out a way to really make a difference in the 5 days he's here. I think he's grown tremendously, as have I. You know, you start a job and you're not good at it. He came in, he didn't like speaking in public. He didn't like doing this. And we would just talk. And I don't know that I'm a great speaker, but I just talk from my heart when I talk. I don't like to read. I just, like today, I just look around the audience and probably missed a few people. But I just look around and then, as I was sitting there, I'm going to say this, this, and this, and this. I'm going to thank this person while I was waiting to speak. And I think that comes off better. And I said, just talk from your heart more, Chief. Like, and you saw him last night at my going away dinner. I think he did that well. He read it, but he talked from his heart, and he's got a lot of emotion and compassion, and he cares about this unit. He cares about this country, and he's a real, real good patriot.
Yeah, and I think if we're honest, we look at this and we say, you know, being a Comanche is a tough job. Comanche for someone like you, that you know, loves to get out in front and really say a lot, and sometimes you say things and people are like, how is he? Why would he say that?
Shelley and Bob are always like, when I speak in public, they're like, you're like one little thing away from getting fired.
It's one of the reasons why I wanted to do this after you got out of command is because I didn't want to be a part of the OSI investigation that took you out of the command, right?
Well, but I've been to the OSI here, Nate.
Yeah, they all right. Know your first name. My brother's OSI.
Russian. So. You've heard my Russian spy story. Yeah, I told the Russian spy story at our first podcast.
Yeah. Yeah, I listened to it.
So. I told it to General Saber when we were driving around yesterday. That was crazy.
But I think that guy, Chief Berrien, has done such a phenomenal job. And what it also did was, here's a guy that didn't know Whiteman was on the map.
He didn't.
Right? And he...
Well, his brother-in-law flies B-2s here.
Yeah. Him and I talked, you know, we've talked a lot, but that guy has never complained.
No.
About this wing. Never complained about the work he's done.
Yeah.
Never complained about the work he does at home. Doesn't complain about the commute. Doesn't complain about, you know, missing time with his kids, any of that stuff. And he loves it. And he's loved this relationship and getting to that he gets to build.
Well, it's cool because he, you know, he'd been a F-16 crew chief, I believe, worked on the flight line, but then he was over in 4th Air Force doing tanker stuff in Abil, and he was never into a combat around a bunch of guys who had been to combat a lot. Mm-hmm. And he hears the stories, and he's just blown away at the crack row, the John Tice, DFC, just the stories and the videos that he's seen. He's just like, wow, like I didn't really know we did this kind of stuff, you know, in the reserves. So it opened his eyes a little bit, and he's been fun to work with. He's also, I think, Nate, done a good job of picking people and surrounding himself. And he came in a tough situation with some shirts who didn't have their school finished, and he had to make some tough calls, and he did, and it wasn't easy. But he surrounded himself with good shirts and good chiefs. And you know how it is when you're in a leadership position. The people that you surround yourself with, like all the accolades that LOM they read, you shouldn't say I. Like, I didn't do any of that. Like, I really didn't. I just put people in a position to do all that stuff. And I think that's the art of leadership, is to get people to want to work hard for the betterment of the organization than themselves, right?
Yeah.
How to get them to buy in, to be selfless, and to stay late to do this, and if you care about them, then they will. That's what I've kind of seen.
I think that's what the difference is, you know. And we look at this, and you know, you look at, we've never had more peer competitors, right? Than right now with the U.S. And I think that the one thing that is on the back of their mind, and the reason why we're still at the top, is because they know that we care about our people. And they know that when you have a person that cares, I listened to some. I was at AFA this year. And they recognized some POWs from Vietnam. They were talking about these POWs. So there was 5 POWs on the stage. They had all done up to 5 years in a POW camp. And they came back to the United States. And you know what they did? They continued to serve in the military.
That's crazy.
And you think about that and you're like, what would cause you to go and spend 5 years being tortured, punished, secluded, you know? And they talked about all the things that these guys did while they're in POW camp and stuff. And it was amazing, right? And then the part that got me, though, and it was just kind of brushed over, is like, then he served 15 more years. And I'm like, what? Like,
we had one of those guys here. Sweetness was a POW, shot down in Desert Storm.
Yep. He spoke it when I was out in survival school.
Yeah.
So, but you look at that, and the only thing that would draw someone back here is that to know that they're loved, they're valued, and to know that this is worth it.
Absolutely.
Right? And so now you talked about, and we look at your life, and we look at this time where you're transitioning, and in these transitions, a lot of times we look at the sacrifices that were made and stuff, and you talk about, you got kids, you know, you got a high schooler, and you've got a Delta job, right? And it's Delta, right?
Yeah.
I don't want to pimp the wrong one. No, I didn't know who Delta. We were sponsored by. I don't say I need a free ride. So then but you got Haley at home, and you're building a house, and you and Haley building a house by yourself, that's got to be stressful for Haley. Especially we talked about that when you have an ADHD.
She's building the house. Yeah. I'm just maybe making some extra money to pay for it.
Yeah. You're funding the general contractor to build this house for you.
She's actually the general contractor.
Yeah.
Yeah, basically.
But you look at all these, and what makes it still worth it for you?
People, the relationships is big time. It's not the money anymore. It's not really the flying anymore because I'm well past my prime, although I still think I'm halfway decent at it.
Yeah, you look like you're still in your prime.
Yeah, not really.
It took a toll on you a little bit.
Yeah, it's the people. It's the joy. This was the best job I've had in the Air Force the last 2 years. Everybody says the 303, being a squadron commander, taking a squadron to combat, I got to do that. I've touched more people in this job by far than I did. I always tell this to people in the wing. I didn't know a lot of these squadrons existed when I was flying in ops. I knew they existed, but it was ops maintenance, man. And we'd do trips and deployments and, yeah, the sea security forces. But those guys, man, they're doing, like, agile combat support deployments for 6 months. And some of the stories I told last night about guys like Devontae and Bolander and Etchie and Navarro and Doc Waterman, some of these people that have deployed, they're giving up. Freaking long time. Keith Yersak went to Panama for 6 months. That's why I tell our pilots over there, I'm like, dudes, you guys have got to do more than just fly airplanes. We go to the wing picnic, get to know some of these people in the wing, because they're every bit that they're supporting you. Mm-hmm. And what you're doing, everybody here is to support that pilot to get him up in the air, whether they're guarding the base, repairing the runway, getting them paid, maintaining the aircraft. They're there too, so they can take off and support that 18-year-old on the ground doing close air support, right? But these people care. They care every bit as much as the guys flying the airplanes. And if you show them that they care and you tie them into that mission, it makes them feel like they're really part of that mission, that they helped save that 18-year-old as well as you did.
And so do you think you've come about that now? But think back to when you were in the 303.
Well, I didn't have that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so what's that, you know, you've got a bunch of pilots that probably listen to this, right? And hopefully the Hogcast. And yeah, so how do you mentor them to say, hey, you know, you're flying one of the greatest airplanes that was ever created.
Yeah.
Living your best life. Now, how do you say there's more to it than just that?
Yeah, you have to be a little bit egocentric. You have to be a little bit arrogant. You have to be a little all of those things to go do that stuff. You just have to be confident. But you have to also realize that you can't be narcissistic and think it's all about you. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of guys that do. I've met a lot of guys. There's commanders that have been that way too, and they haven't been good. The good ones know that there's more people involved than just them, or the accolades aren't just about them, you know. So yeah, I would just say get out and meet people. Like talk to your. Like I had a crew chief last night tell me, he goes, when you were a captain, you came out to fly with me, and you called me by my first name, and you knew my name. It made me feel like I was a human being to you. And I thank you. And that showed me that you cared enough to call me by my first name. And it wasn't like.
But that's one of the top five reasons why people get out, right? It's not money or rank.
Yeah.
It's not feeling valued.
Yeah.
Calling someone by their name. So there, I've studied this a lot. When I say, you know, Steven or Steve, there's in your brain, it triggers something that releases an endorphin in you that is not like any other word that ever gets said to you.
Yeah, or nasty.
Yeah, or nasty, call me nasty, right?
Yeah.
It releases something different. And so calling someone by their name, it gives them value and it releases something inside of them that makes them feel good.
Absolutely.
And knowing someone's name instead of just, you know, Sarge or whatever,
yeah.
Whatever you want to call them, right? Instead of just barking out orders, yeah. Right? It's
you, every time I get on the headset with the crew chief, I usually... while I'm getting ready to fly, hey, where are you from? What are you doing? What's your status out here? TR, active duty. And then I'll usually go, what do you want to do? Where do you want to be in 10 years?
Yeah.
Do you want to be in art? If you're a TR, do you look for a full-time job? Are you working on your degree? What's your degree in? Do you want to be an officer? Do you want to be a chief? What's your goal? And how can I help you get to that goal? Especially right. As I got into a position where I could.
Mm-hmm. Doesn't that feel good, though, too,
awesome.
As a leader, to be able to see people? You know, one of the greatest things that I got to see was helping someone get their citizenship.
That's very right? cool.
And it was like they became an American.
Yeah.
Like, you know, and it permeated through my whole life to where then I had a guy that was pouring concrete at my house one time in Vegas, and he he's like, I'd really love to be a citizen, but I've just, and I walked him through the process, walked with him, and he came back by my house like 6 months later, and it's like, I became a citizen today. I gave him an American flag. I'm like, welcome to the team, awesome. Man. You know, but there's nothing, that's the piece about leadership that I think sometimes they get, you know, people don't realize when they're not in a position like that, is it's the ability to use that leadership to help others that really makes it worth it.
Totally. Like, right? Etchy, we did the interview with Etchy, the guy from Africa that we sent home for the holidays. He came by my office this morning.
I saw him, yeah.
To shake hands with me, to say thank you. And he wanted more information on how to become an officer. He's got his degree. He wants to become an officer in the wing. So Chief Barry and B-Light were talking to him about the next deserving airman boards. And I'm like, and he thanked me. But I said to him, I'm like, no. Thank you. Me interviewing you inspired me. And I tell your story all the time. And I'll continue to tell it, because I don't just get inspiration from 4-star generals.
Yeah.
I get inspiration from Etchy, from Doc Waterman, from Mandy Speaker, from Bob Jennings, from you, both of your guys' resilient stories. You don't have to be a 4-star general to inspire someone. You could be, I told the story about Denang, the guy that won the innovation contest, Denali.
Denali Nadig.
He was my crew chief one day, and I pulled in early, and I come parking, and this kid comes sprinting across the flight line. And I'm like, what in the hell are you doing? He gets on the headset. He goes, I don't want to make you wait, sir. And I'm just, he was so driven and so focused and wanted to do the best job. And now to see him working over in the innovation lab at StealthWorks, it's awesome. But I told him that when we called him up to give him an award. I think it's when I pinned on General, we had him up on stage, and I gave him the innovation contest award. I'm like, you inspired me that day. You ran across the ramp.
Yeah. And it's crazy to think, I've sat next to Rhino at the ceremony out here, and a guy that had so much, you know, influence, and I got to watch lead, you know, and him and General Borg and General Mackey, and just, you know, Colonel Hoff, you know, he was out there, and just all these leaders. And Rhino said something to me that really took me back. And he said, man, I was talking the other day with some people, and about people who had influenced our lives. And he said, I brought your name up on how you'd influenced my life. And I was like, how in the world did I, like, I looked at these people for, and I think that's one of the things that makes you great. I think it's a similar thing with me, is we draw so much inspiration from people.
Yeah.
And in turn, that inspiration that we gather, like, just like all those people that you just talked to were inspired by, it's kind of this whole, you both are getting inspired by listening to each other's story and helping each other out.
Yeah.
You know, and I talk about that a lot. It's just, if you just sit in your little bubble, this could be a terrible job.
Terrible. And when we had Simon Sinek talk to us, what he kind of told us is that's what makes good organizations run well. When people feel appreciated and they can inspire each other, then that generates innovation and ideas, and companies don't become stale, right? Like, he gave several examples of companies that didn't keep innovating, and how other companies like Apple and Tesla. I told him, I mean, the Air Force isn't built that way. We're not for profit. We're not this. We're not that. How can we, as a military, we waste a ton of money on just the way that's budgeted from Congress. You get $30 million to spend for a wing, and if you don't spend that $30 million, you're not going to get $30 million next year.
Yeah.
Well, that seems wasteful if it only takes $25 million to run this wing.
This year versus next year, they take $45
million. Yeah. Like, where's the incentive? How do I, if it's not for profit, what do I do? And I just try to make it, our job is really to train people to be ready and mentally, physically, and their job ready to go to combat and perform a job at a high level, and to make sure that they're medically ready, physically ready, spiritually ready, and then have the job skill set to go do a job at a high level. Because when you get put in a situation, you've flown RPAs and different things, and when you get put in a situation where if you have to make a mistake on a battlefield, it's going to cost somebody's life. You can't think. You have to be so well trained, whether you're loading the weapon, launching the jet, and seconds matter, right? Or whether you're squeezing the trigger, if you don't have that training. So that's kind of our profit, is the training that we're giving
and
these
you don't,
people.
And you don't have time to micromanage it, right? You got to know that that person next to you, you don't have time to watch every single thing that the crew chief's doing on the airplane to make sure they're doing it right. You're getting into combat. You're trusting that those people have done their job up to that point, right? And I think that goes back to the point that you're making about Simon Sinek, is we've got to train up. I think of this a lot as, this mission won't fail, but it's not because, you know, politicians fund us correctly, you know, because that's not the case. This mission won't fail, but it won't fail because we have such, you know, great leaders or great whatever. This mission won't fail because we have great people that aren't willing to let it fail.
Yeah.
That will do whatever. If you short them, if they're supposed to have 17 crew chiefs out there and they have two, they're going to make it happen. They're going to sprint across the ramp, right? And it's such an inspiration to see that and to see.
A little bit of my fear is that our enlisted force, I think the thing that sets us apart, and I hope it continues, is the Russians and the Chinese. The Russians don't treat their enlisted people well. No. They're just bodies, and they just go to the front of Ukraine.
It's forced.
It's just forced. The Chinese army, military exists for the Communist Party. And most of the people in the party are officers. The enlisted people in their military are conscripts, and they're not a part of the party, to the point that they don't trust them. Is they won't let a enlisted person launch one of their aircraft. They have officers that are maintainers because they don't trust their enlisted force.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a huge deal, and it's a way for us to develop more trust. And my concern, Nate, is that fewer and fewer people are fit to wear the uniform. I think 0.4% of the population is in the uniform. Where are we going to get these citizen airmen, these volunteer forces? It's all volunteer, active, so guard, reserve.
Yeah. I love talking about that, right? And I talked to some of your groups about this, and I told a story yesterday to some of them that were in there about this. In 2012, there was a group in Afghanistan, and it was, you know, a group that was about from age 12 to age 24, somewhere in there, right? And they were training this group up, and they were in this like little village or whatever. So we're watching them, we're watching this group, we're seeing what they're doing. We're like, hey, at that time we were taking out a lot of terrorist camp or training camps and stuff like that. So they're watching, they're like, hey, this is going to be a terrorist training camp. Like these people are like a pre-training to go to this camp. So they're watching, they're running up mountains. They got packs on their back. They're you could obviously training for something. And they're like, there's no sporting event that these people are training for in Afghanistan in the middle of the mountains. There's no, the only thing they can really be training for is war, right? So they're doing all this training, and then one day it happens. They all get together. They pack up these packs, and they can tell they're saying them goodbyes, and they take off. And they take off up a mountain. So they're following them. They're like, they're going to lead us to this bigger training camp, and this is going to be it. We're going to be able to strike this big terrorist camp. What they find out, they get humid, and the humid comes back and says, they gathered them together, and they said, listen, you're about to go on a 4,000-mile journey across four countries that are all hostile. At any point you come in contact with hostiles, you'll probably die. You're going to go across all seasons, and you're going to go through the highest mountains, and you're going to face weather, and some of you will die. If you get sick, the group has been told to leave you behind. If you get injured, you will be left behind. Some of you will have to be used as a price for the rest of your freedom.
Crazy.
And all of this, if you complete this journey, all of this, you may get to experience the greatest thing in the world, and that's freedom. These parents packed up their kids and sent them across all of this.
I thought you were going to tell me they were terrorists.
No.
Yeah.
Across all this land just to get to Europe, to where they can experience freedom and hopefully get to the United States. I think that is the key when you talk about where are we going to get people, is when we start experience this freedom more, when we start recognizing this, and there's a lot of things I always say is the Communist Party doesn't think that they can convert, you know, General Nestor over to be a communist.
Yeah.
But what they do believe is that they can make you disagree with, you know, Sergeant Jennings, to where Sergeant Jennings doesn't want to listen to what you have to say.
Yeah.
Or, I think that all of the walking around, the more we get to know people, the more, but here's what I'll tell you is, we've also been fed a bill of goods that is false. I went to basic training not too long ago, and I watched as 700 airmen showed up. Every Tuesday, 700 people volunteer still to show up to join the Air Force. 700.
That's awesome.
And I think as long as we can do that, we'll keep creating it. Now, I think what you're talking about is we've definitely got to, everything that you talked about is, you know, you've got to get out and know your people. You got to know when they're suffering and you got to care. Because if you care for them, I think they step up when all of this is going on.
No, I do too. And that's a good point. Like, I have college age kids. My daughter goes to UCSB in Santa Barbara. It's a pretty liberal school. Mm-hmm. Her first few years, she was a little liberal when she came home from Thanksgiving, Christmas, mm-hmm. and I'd have get into disagreements with her about it. And I was like, she's little, she's matured. She sees both sides of it now mm-hmm. that she's getting her own money, job, taxes, different things. And she can have her own opinion. That's great. But like I tell all my kids, I'm like, hey, you have the opportunity to go to college and freedom. And I've been all over the world, man. I traveled to Australia, Japan, Korea, China, Europe. I've been everywhere. And I still don't think there's any place that compares to the United States. Even with our issues now and the divisiveness in our political parties, there's still a core of people in this country that believe in the freedom and want the freedom for their kids. And you know, my dad, my wife, my mom's father got shot down in World War II. Those people like gave me the opportunity and all the stuff that I've had a great life, and it's because of those people.
Yeah, Ronald Reagan says that he said that freedom is always one generation away from being extinct.
Absolutely.
Right, and so it's our jobs as leaders
to pass
to
that
inspire
on.
The next generation to want to do whatever it takes.
Yeah,
you know, for freedom. I think of when we were in Iraq in 2003 in Talil, and I remember going off base one time, and they had set up a school, right, and there was these people crying and everything else, and there we had a translator with us and a guy that was guiding us, right? We went out to like the...
Did you go to City of Ur?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was great.
So, yeah, we went out, and it was so moving, right? But we stopped by the school, and there's these people crying and whatnot, and what were they crying about? It's like, oh, this is the first time little girls have got to go to school. I think we were part of that by being there. And you talk about tying the mission, right? Is I had a chief friend of mine that he said every time he walked around, his people on base knew. If he talked to you, he was going to ask you, what's the 3 degrees of you getting warfighters downrange? Because I want you that connected to the
mission.
Mission. You know, and I think if we could give advice to those young fighter pilots that are over there is, hey, tie people to the mission everywhere you go. When you go get your flu shot, you should be talking about how that makes you ready.
Yeah, absolutely.
To go for the mission.
Yeah.
You know, I watched the people that were given, the med people that were given flu shots today, man. She was aggressively out there. Flu shots? You know, it was like she was selling cotton candy.
Dang, I forgot to get my flu shot today.
Well, you probably still can. There's still time before you get off base.
Yeah.
But so let's talk about real quick, like, what's next for you?
I'm driving to Utah.
Yeah.
Right now.
Yeah, with a bunch of gifts in the back, right?
And the gun barrel fit.
Wall hangers.
My truck looks like a friggin' jingle truck in Afghanistan or something. Uniforms, clothes everywhere. No, I'm going to Utah to go home for a few days. And then my next job is going to be it's an MA job, mobilization assistant to the first Air Force commander in Tyndall Air Force Base. It's a NORAD, NORTHCOM mission, where our job is to defend the homeland. And I'll be a deputy CFAC for that, like 5-6 days a month down there. And I'll be doing some other stuff. Schools, DT boards, schools for myself. I get to go to a really cool security school middle of November in D.C.
Yeah, and the driving school.
The driving shooting
school.
It's
pretty awesome.
I haven't had time to do a lot of that stuff, so they want me to do some more schools. Mm-hmm. So give me some time to do that. And I want to really spend some more time with my family, get in our house, get moved in. My son's got 2 more years. And you know, when your kids go to college, they're kind of gone.
Yeah.
It's crazy. Like, they're home, but they're not. And that 18 years, so I got 2 more years with my youngest son, and he's playing baseball. I want to spend more time with him and my wife. We like skiing together and hiking and enjoying the mountains up in Park City. I need to be, my wife always teases me because she comes to these things and people sing my praises and my ego. I don't know. I don't try not to have an ego, but she's like, oh my God, you're gonna have a big ego when you get home. She's like, why can't you be that guy at our house?
Yeah.
And I'm like, well, I try to be, but my kids don't listen to me.
Yes, yeah.
It's different. Yeah. These people, like some of them, not all of them don't listen to me here. But she goes, no, you're like a transformational leader there. I need that at home more. And she's probably right. I don't. Part of it is sometimes when I am home, this job is still encompassing my mind to where it's not fair. I probably have put my family on the back burner too often and my kids. So I want to do more of that stuff with my family. So I'll go to that job, man. I don't know what's next. Torch asked me for my dream sheet the other day for her husband. We'll see what's next. I don't know. I'd like to have an opportunity to lead people again someday and get back into an operational wing, or not a wing, but an operational kind of mission.
Like, yeah.
Whether it's like PACAF job was cool because it was mission related, A3 operations.
Yeah, First Air Force is going to be a good mission too.
Yeah.
So my buddy, Chief Jimmy Burmeister, is down there.
Oh, yeah.
So he's one that you guys would get along great.
Cool.
He's an awesome dude. He's a good one to probably look up. I'll hook you guys up together. But
yeah,
he's been down there as an IMA to the command chief at First Air Force for a while. And they just, I hear about that mission all the time, and he just loves it.
That's
so
very cool.
So look forward to it.
When are you heading back to D.C.?
I'll head back tomorrow. But
What's a life like in D.C. for your job?
So Pentagon, man, I tell you, if you would have told me 4 years ago I was going to the Pentagon, I probably would have fought myself, right? And I probably would have done something to try to not go.
How far away from the Pentagon do you live?
So I live 32 miles. So in the mornings, if I leave before 6:15, 6:20, it takes me about 45 minutes.
Drive, train?
Drive. And then if I ride
to park, right?
Yeah. So parking, I park about 0.7 miles away from the,
you don't get the chief spot.
Yeah. So the first time I was there, I made a video for social media of just, they must not have known I was coming because I park and then the video, it's like, you could barely see the Pentagon in the far distance. I was like, I got to walk all that day.
I've heard that like the one stars are like getting coffee and they don't even have a good parking spot.
No, that's, if you got a parking pass,
you could park in the inspected mothers.
But it's one of the things I've noticed about you and I that I think is similar, is that no matter how far we get, whether it's First Air Force, whether it's, I remember going to the Pentagon, and that's just one of the things about it, is I got there and General Berger said, hey, can you come down to this meeting? We're going to do this development meeting and I want to talk to you about some of the task org stuff and everything. So I go and it's like, you know, General Berger, there's a couple other generals and then there's some O6s in the room. And so he's talking about balancing the J-books, and he says J-books no less than 30 times in the first 5 minutes of the meeting. So I write this little note, like, what's a J-book? Because I wanted to sit up against the wall, and he's like, no, sit up here at the table, sit next to me. So I kind of show him the note, and he's like, hey, stop a second. Who here doesn't know what J-books are? And I'm like, what a jerk. That dude's going to call me out in front of this meeting. Like, in half the room didn't know what J-books
were. But did they raise their hand?
No, nobody. But that's, I think, one of the things for you and I as we go through this is not afraid that I'm not afraid to be the dumbest person in the room.
I usually am.
I'd rather be the dumbest person in that room than an airman to ask me, you know, about a resource and I don't know.
Yeah.
Because I didn't ask that question along the way. And yeah. So it's one of those things, is I think we play up sometimes, you know, our you know, your ADHD, number one.
I learned that at PACAF when I went into a meeting with General Wilsbach. I was the three that week, and they threw out acronyms. I had no idea. Most of it was about meetings and their routine. And I'm like, look, I don't. If he asked me a question I didn't know, I'd learn very quickly not to bullshit him.
Yeah.
But I would, hey, I will find out, and I'll get you that answer in 30 minutes. I'll go ask somebody that's an expert on that. Or, I don't know, let me call Indo-Pacom, or let me get you an answer. But if you bullshitted him and he found out, it was not good.
Yeah.
It was not good.
Yeah. I've always liked to say, explain to me that like I don't understand. And I didn't understand it like the whole time. But being at the Pentagon, you know, this is the first time in 26 years that my brother and I joined the military together in 1996. And we both left at that time. The last time I lived by my brother was in 1994 before he left for college.
That's cool.
And so he's OSI, retired, had a job out in D.C.
And he's moving to Texas now?
Yeah, so he was out there in D.C. So I've got to watch my nephew and my niece a little bit in school ball and stuff like that. And just been great. This was the first time in my youngest, my 14-year-old Paul's life, that he's had a relative on the emergency contact list for school.
That's really cool.
And so usually we move into a neighborhood and then like crazies, we're like, hey, if something was to happen to us, would you pick our kids up?
How is it being back in Missouri?
And it's surreal, you know, walking around. I literally, you know, about broke down yesterday. I walked down and I'll try to talk about this without breaking down now, is I walked in and I walked down to the weight room in the 303rd. And Yeti and I spent so much time.
Oh, yeah.
When we came in early mornings and we'd ride in together. So I got to carpool in with him a lot. And
I didn't know that.
Yeah. So I my claim to fame with Yeti is that I'm the only person that ever consistently got him to go to church. So that's, he used to go to church with me.
Did he really?
All the time. Yeah, him and Becca would go every Sunday with us. And I remember one time sitting in church with Yeti, and he said, he leaned over. I thought he was going to say something like, you know, like moving. And he's real, you know, he's got the barroom whisper, and he's like, I don't understand how that drummer drums with his shirt on. That was it. Then he leads back. I'm like, I don't know what to do with this information.
For those of you who don't know, Yeti's the pilot that we lost three or four years ago to an airplane accident in Texas. Just a character, but he was a really smart guy, and he would love to, like when I would stay here, if I got a house or had an extra bed, he was too lazy to make a reservation.
Yeah.
When he was coming up from Texas, he was like, you got the house? I'm bunking with you. And but he was a smart dude, man. Holy cow. I miss that guy tremendously. He was awesome. I remember when did you sell your land down?
Yeah, so I had 90 acres down in by Warsaw, Missouri, yeah.
And that's actually when I got in trouble, almost got fired, man. I drove the soft car down there with four guys.
Because we were running JTAC operations down there.
Yeah, and it was after duty, and I didn't want to. It was raining and muddy, and nobody wanted to take their car, so we took the soft truck. It was an old Ford
Explorer. Yeah.
And we drive down, we shoot, and we didn't want to spend the night down there. Some guys were going to play poker and do some drinking, and we're like, we got to get up tomorrow. I think we're flying. So Thor Shelton, a couple other guys, I was driving, and we get caught in this creek, freaking flooded, and the SUV starts, it's lifted by the creek, and Thor jumps out of the car. He had, like, waders on and pushes it across the swollen creek. And the engine dies, and we can't get the thing started. And the guy in front of us is there. It's pouring rain, this huge thunderstorm. And he had a tow strap, and we were only about 4 miles from the front gate.
Yeah.
And he tows us to the front gate. We go through the gate, walk the building, and go to bed. We just left it there at the visitor center. And I called Jim Bolin, who is deceased. He was working in vehicle ops, LRS guy, the next day. And I'm like, hey, Jim, man.
Something's
wrong with the soft truck. I drove through a flooded creek last night, and word got out that I had taken it off base. Colonel Clemens was the wing commander. I was like 6 months away from being the next squadron commander.
Mm-hmm.
And he made Borg give me a letter of counseling. And he says, that son of a bitch will never be the squadron commander for doing this.
Look at you now.
Look at me now. Yeah, he wasn't a big fan of me.
So that was when, that property down there, I was on the police department at the time, right? So a buddy of mine, Nick Spencer, he was on a SWAT team and stuff. And so that we had brought fully automatic weapons down there.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And so we had this line, and everybody was wearing their squadron shirts. And remember, we had that was one thing we did jack around with when it came to
safety, yeah.
And so we had this straight line of people shooting. And you could take turns shooting on the fully automatic. And we had some law enforcement officers down there. And so I'd called the Sheriff Agent at the time. And I said, hey, you know, we're going to be down here shooting. We're going to have some military members and some law enforcement officers. And there's going to be a fully automatic weapon. And so he's like, not a problem, Nate. You know, let us know if you need anything. I said, okay, thanks, man. Well, he didn't tell his deputies. So someone called in, one of the neighbors down there called in. Hey, there's a lot of shooting going on. Sounds like a war, and there's some fully automatic weapons over there. So we were out there shooting.
Can you imagine doing that today?
I look up at the gate of my property, and there's a deputy up there. So I go driving up there in the four-wheeler, and I said, hey, man, you know, Nate Parks, I own the property here. And I said, I already talked to Sheriff Agent, and he's like, oh, yeah. He said, I'm just going to leave. And I go, oh, okay, they let you know. And he goes, no, he didn't let me know. But I came out here, and every single one of you are wearing bright red shirts. Shooting weapons downrange in a line, and it's like military style. And he goes, I told him, we don't have the kind of firepower to deal with this. Tell him everything's fine.
Oh, some of those weapons were crazy. I remember shooting those that night.
We shot, that was Coup de Marks. He shot at 842 yards was the longest.
Seriously?
Yeah, that was a long shot that we had out there.
Those are some fun times, man. We had some hell of a good times back then. We talked a little bit about G-Tard.
And
the Eddie, and I think we had a lot more characters back in our unit than we do now.
So one of the guys that I remember distinctly that was very unique, that a lot of people don't remember, was HQ Bob.
We were talking about him last night.
Bob Hubden, right?
Yeah, he raced motorcycles. He drank milk. He carried a gallon of milk around.
Half gallon.
Everywhere.
Half gallon milk.
Yeah, he would just sit it on the desk. He'd just drink milk out of the bottle.
And it would get warm. He'd still drink it.
He'd go fly. He raced motorcycles. He was crazy.
Dirt track breaker.
He crashed. He would do
crop dusting.
Crop dusting. He crashed his plane two or three times. Yep. I mean, he was insane.
Yeah.
He flew for a cargo outfit he went all over the world flying cargo around. I mean, this guy was a character.
But I think of that now, and they called him HQ Bob because he worked at AFRIC, and he was just attached to us. And I'm like, what did that guy do at AFRIC?
I don't know.
I don't know that he was even. I think he was like the
A-10 fam down there or something.
I kind of feel like he Costanza this. He didn't actually fly A-10s at all. Like he came out.
He flew A-10s with us.
Yeah, no, that's what I'm saying. Yeah. He just kind of came in. It's like, yeah, I'm good.
Yeah.
We were all like, he's not on letter X's, but let's give this guy a shot.
He was crazy. Holy cow. I was crazy. That's a hard thing. It is. A real won't have a hard time. But when you're kind of crazy young, a lot of these enlisted guys knew me as nasty. Crazy stories, all this different stuff. I'm talking Kim Stone and Kathy Roberts and Keith Yersak when they were enlisted. And to go from that guy and then to be in charge, it's difficult because they know some. But I also think it does. You can work it in your benefit because you go, I'm a human being, man, just like you guys.
Yeah.
I made mistakes. I did
so many. Yeah.
Stupid stuff.
Yep.
But guess what? I probably grew and learned and matured. I'm not mature, but I learned my lesson on a lot of stuff. Maybe got that out of my system. And they know that, hey, this guy, when I came back here, a lot of guys were like, oh, God, so good to have one of us leading you. It can't be that inclusive
incestuous.
Incestuous is the word. It is good to go out of here and see other stuff.
Absolutely.
It's been other places, and I think Patriot Fury really opened his eyes to the NAFs and AFRC, and that was basically a staff job for a year and a half for that guy. So he's got that skill set now.
So what do you think, you're walking out the door? You know, couple things. One, what are you most proud of here? Because the chances are, not the chances, there's no way for you to come back to the 442nd.
Oh, yeah.
So
there's no job to go
to. So you're done here.
Yeah.
And your time here. What are you most proud of?
I'm just most proud of the relationships I have walking out of here.
Yeah.
The people that I've connected with and that I'll have for the rest of my life. That's the, Bob and Shelley and you and people from all walks of life that I met here that I consider friends. And, you can fly airplanes, have 7,000 hours, but you'll be pretty lonely at the end of your life if you don't have a lot of friends. So I would say I'm most proud of the people I've become friends with and the relationships I've built here. Definitely.
Yeah.
You asked me earlier some stuff that I didn't get to do that I wanted to finish. Hopefully Rio will.
I wanted
to have another offsite leadership deal because I think the one we had, I don't know if you went, Bob, with Simon Sinek was outstanding in Kansas City. Riddler spoke the first day. Simon spoke the second day. We bonded. We had a fun dinner. I always wanted to do another one. I wanted to get another speaker, and I had Bill Curry in to speak when I was the vice wing commander, who was excellent. I had some people I wanted to get in. I wanted to get in the guy that runs Folds of Honor. I knew him. I used to fly against him when he was flying F-16s. I forget his name. Anyway, I contacted him. We had it all set up, but then he scheduled thing. I wanted to have him in. I want to have Casey Campbell in to talk to the wing about her story.
Her picture's up in the Pentagon.
I think it would be cool to have a female, and we're talking about that with Torch, talk to our group about leadership, and she's good at what she does. So I wanted to do some more of that kind of leadership stuff to like I, sometimes I go to the 10th Air Force thing, so I'm like, you guys are missing an opportunity to have people like that come speak, like a Simon Sinek or whoever, because you're really trying to develop these people to be really good leaders. And we would just sit around and talk about A1 through A9 and money and budgets and staffs. And I'm like,
Chief Bass does a good job of that. She always brings in a good speaker.
Yeah, I want
someone inspirational and development.
Inspire and develop leaders. That's what we're trying to do. And I wish I would have done another one of those. And then, no, we did, we went to Europe, we went to Peru, we did a lot of stuff that I had set out to do in my command and getting people to Aviano and doing other things. They got some great trips set up for next year. So I walk away from here pretty proud.
Yeah. I think you missed a big one.
What?
So I think hopefully Colonel Ioannis closes the deal on a another mission.
Oh, God. Yeah. That's huge.
Yeah. But I know that's a given. That's not really him either.
Colonel Ioannis. No. But, and I'll fight for it. I got contacts with retired General Jackson, who used to be the
AA. But when they do get a new mission, I will, every time I see you or him, be like, hey, he was able to do what you couldn't do. And that's the kind of mission here.
That's true, man. Yeah. The other thing I'm a little disappointed in this. I'd like to see the star. Stay here in the 442nd.
The
one star billet.
Who knows with the new mission?
Hopefully it'll come back to this wing if we get a F-35 or a Strike Eagle. I think wings that own iron should have that one star position. If we only have 2 and 10th, I think that this place, I get it. They move it around for different people and all that stuff, but. If you look at the history, I tried to show that to Torch when she came through here, and I showed her McIntosh, Bradley, Stinner, all went on to be AFRC commanders.
You think Nestor will be in that?
No, I'm too old, I think. My dad was very, very close to being a CAFR, and he had lost his airline job, and he really wanted to do that job. And it was interesting, when I took this job, he kind of told me not to because it would be too busy as a reservist with my family. He goes, just stay in Hawaii. And I'm like, Dad, that's boring. Like, I like the MA job, but I want to lead people. Mm-hmm. And this is what I want to do. And
that ADHD pays off. It really does, I think, in when it comes to like stuff like this.
Yeah.
Because you're always wanting to learn something.
It's crazy. I get really – that's why I like golf, because I golf and golf and golf, and I can never – get good enough.
Mm-hmm.
And I always want to shoot par.
Mm-hmm.
I've never shot 72. I've shot 74, 75, and I'm crazy about it. I go practice all the time, and I'm like, I'm getting worse actually. But and yes, we want to do next. And I told my dad was asking about jobs and two-star jobs and what I put on the list, and I put on there a joint job in Sea Springs because it's closer to my house. The PAC-F, it made the PAC-F commander, 10th Air Force, I put on there. And he's like, 10th Air Force commander? Because my dad was a vice, 10th Air Force vice, and he had Cheese's job, was his last job. And I'm like, yeah, why not? That'd be pretty cool. And he was like, oh, it's too much work. I mean, you'd never be home. And I'm like, we'll see what happens. My kids are out of college. My wife's on board. But
Haley probably she'll want to build another house by then.
I doubt it. But anyway, that I don't know. That I'm also, 54, and see what happens next. But I've had some. It's been awesome.
So to kind of wrap this up, how do you want the airmen here at Whiteman to remember you? What do you hope that they remember about you?
Just somebody that's just like them. I'm a human being just like them, and somebody that cared about them. I'm no different than them. Just because I'm a general doesn't make me any better than anybody else here. I hope they say that was a guy that cared about us, that was like us, that was part of our tribe, and he did what he could to protect us and get another mission for us as well here. And that's it, and a good friend. That's it.
That's so awesome. When I left Grissom, they gave me a WWE belt that said the People's Chief.
That's cool.
And I was like, I don't know that you could have given me a better compliment, than that. Well, I want to thank you And I don't want to just thank you for, you know, letting me do this, but also, you know, this is where a lot of time I call home. You know, I grew up down in Warsaw, on the lake, watching the A-10s fly over. And I remember the first time a B-2 flew over in practice and how we stopped the football practice and watched a B-2.
That's pretty cool. And I've bombed Warsaw into submission over the last 25 years.
But they're still going.
I've hit the dam. I've hit baseball fields, everything.
My property down there.
The VFW tank. I've slammed Mavericks into that thousands of times.
But it's, I feel like this is, if someone asked me where my home unit was, it would be this one.
Yeah, same.
And part of that is because I owe a debt of gratitude for how they treated me and how they saved me. And so from being a member here, being a person that feels like this is home, I've experienced firsthand how much it takes to be part of the wing command staff and how I feel like we're a lot alike in the fact that we joke around a lot.
Yeah.
We take a lot of stuff lighthearted, but we take a lot of stuff to heart. And the pain that those airmen had while you were here, you felt.
Oh, yeah.
You suffered. You went through it. The turmoil, that's why the talks were so emotional. It was because of those moments that you got to walk through with those members.
Yeah.
And it takes a toll on you.
It does.
And it takes energy. It takes effort. It takes probably you going back home and being like freaking wore out from a UTA. And Haley's probably like, you've walked around and talked to people. But it's an emotional
drain. And so every Sunday night of UTA, I would tell my wife, and Chief Barry would usually travel home on Sunday. And I go, I'm too tired to travel home on Sundays because I'm talking to people all day and doing this and that. So Sunday, I go, I just want to either go play golf or work out or unwind and not talk to anybody for a couple of hours. Yeah. Right? And that's probably what I'll do when I'm driving to Denver tonight in Utah is just reflect and go, hey, that was – I do feel like there's a weight lifted off me, right? Yeah. I really do. But I'll reflect on all the stories that the fun times I've had, not only the last 2 years, but the last 26.
Yeah, so I just wanted to say thanks as someone who's been influenced by you, someone who stole a lot from you, and someone who continues and wants to do that. But as a friend, you know, as a fellow 442nd member, just thanks for what you've done for this wing.
Awesome.
And the mark that you've left on this wing, we've all got a story about Nasty, but there's also most of us that have a story about how you came and you were there in that moment. And so I think that's what matters. And I think when it comes time, when you talk about that freedom that needs to be defended, it's those moments that you provided that are going to inspire us all to pick up arms and take off.
Good.
And ready to go.
That's what it's all about, right?
Yeah. So thanks a lot.
Thanks, Nate.
Yeah.
Appreciate it. Thanks, Bob.